Hickey, hockey, holy, bagel, bugle, bowling, macadamia, vestibule, pina colada, managua, velcro, escargot, malarkey, peccadillo, glockenspiel, tonto, caledonia, bingo, pink, pneumonia, hokey pokey, hoi polloi, carbuncle, fungus, osmosis, tutu, Taiwan, halitosis, pickles, ecto, parasite, Messerschmitt, macaroon, malamute, mezzanine, vehicle, ventricle, varsity, Vaseline, kickapoo, kangaroo, cul-de-sac, Erie Canal.
Yes, that is the genius, Haywood Banks. And it's a sign that we're going to do a show about words, because, in fact, we're going to do a show about words and how they get used, how they get turned around, warped, changed, mutated, revived. I don't know. I'm searching for words now at this point, and I would be better off probably introducing our guests. So for the first two segments, we'll be visiting with a frequent guest on this show. Peter Sokolowski is editor-at-large at Merriam-Webster, public radio jazz host extraordinaire at New England Public Media, and co-host of the Word Matters podcast. Also with us, Corey Stamper, a lexicographer and author of Word by Word, The Secret Life of Dictionaries. So, first of all, welcome to both of you. And Peter, you know, I mean, dictionaries used to sort of just sit between covers. They were on pages. They sat between covers. They didn't change much until somebody put out a new edition. But, you know, I mean, every day's a busy day at Merriam-Webster, right? We know what people are looking up right now. For some reason, they've been looking up the word gaff all day. I've been watching. And Merriam-Webster has on their site this lookup chart that refreshes, I don't know, every 30 seconds or something. But gaff is hung in there. Gaff, delve, CO, dense, bony, in all caps, inhabited, neurasthenia, which also has had a good day so far, awe, democracy, and karma are all being looked up a lot. So, Peter, first of all, do you always know why people are looking, do you know why people are looking up gaff today? I can't figure it out.
Absolutely not. I mean, I always say we're good at reading data. We're not good at reading minds. And sometimes those words being looked up are obvious. They're from, you know, a pandemic, for example, or from an insurrection. And we can follow the vocabulary right to the news, or, for example, to the title of a movie. Inception was a word that people looked up a lot when that movie came out. Sometimes gaff spikes when there's a public error of one kind. I remember when the Oscar was given to the wrong film, as you might recall, that the word gaff is a favorite for headline writers, and it became a word that spiked in our data. So you never really know. And another interesting point is that it's not always a difficult vocabulary word that's being looked up. Sometimes they're quite common words. When Princess Diana died, one of the top lookups was the word princess.
Right. But usually, well, who knows whether it's usually or not. I should say one interesting thing about gaff is, among reporters anyway, the most famous definition of gaff is not one that's found in any dictionary, to the best of my knowledge, but it's the one that another journalist, Michael Kinsley, made, like, I don't know, 30, 40 years ago. He said he defined gaff as an instance when a politician by mistake tells the truth. Which, you know, is that sort of the gaff is the kind of thing that is blurted out. But Corey, and this is something that you've written a lot about, there is a sense, I think, in the world of politics and public life, kind of win the battle of the word and you win a lot of other battles, right? If you can get everybody to refer to part of the Affordable Care Act as death panels, you've effectively, you know, made an inroad that means more than just terminology.
Absolutely. If the ideas that we use language to describe are really what we're trying to spread, and language is catchy, it's viral by nature. And so if you can take a word, or you can get a word trending, or you can attach an idea to a word or divorce an idea from a word, that's really how we end up getting ideas spread. That's how different ways of I wouldn't say manipulating information, but sometimes manipulating information or what kind of information reaches people happens. So absolutely, the war of the word is sort of always has been, honestly, one of the main ways that we fight for dominance in the marketplace of ideas.
Yeah, it's sort of funny the way that what's happening today is kind of what happens all the time. I was teaching a political science journalism class, a seminar this spring, and I kind of had a free parking space. One of the class meetings, I hadn't really decided what I wanted to do, and we all talked about what we wanted to do, and we decided we would talk about words in kind of the way that the three of us are talking about it right now. And then we thought, oh, what a great choice, because that week, you know, genocide was being fervently debated in connection with Ukraine and grooming and gaslighting. There's just the G's, genocide, grooming, right, and gaslighting. I mean, it would seem like it was a really big week in words, but that's probably wrong. It's probably always a really big week in words. We're just always arguing about something else.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the things that's interesting about the way that modern discourse around words happens is it's happening in real time. You know, 100 years ago, this kind of discourse happened in newspapers, or, you know, it might have happened on radio, but rarely. And now it's happening, you know, on broadcast TV, on social media, on the internet. You can see public editors at different, you know, newspapers, magazines, issuing statements about why we're calling it this and not the other word, or why we're not using this word versus the other word. And so, yeah, I mean, this has always happened, and it's happening all around us, whether we're paying attention to it or not. I just think we've had a lot of big things happen in the last few years, so we're paying more attention to those sorts of things.
Although, yeah, that whole question of why use that word instead of another word, I mean, in public radio, and this goes back a few years now, there was quite a brouhaha about the word torture, because, in fact, mm-hmm. public radio, as a matter of style, had decided not to refer to waterboarding as torture. And people got, I mean, it was at that point, you know, there was, I think Alicia Shepard was the ombudsperson, but, you know, there was like a big fight about that. And I remember Bob Garfield in particular from On the Media getting furious, saying, why in the world wouldn't we call that torture? But Corey, that's another example of however that battle goes, it does affect probably perception.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think perception also affects that battle, honestly. I think, I mean, one thing I like to do is I like to collect headlines that use the word lie, as in a falsehood, because in journalistic practice, they tell you, don't call something a lie unless you can prove intent to deceive. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's in theory, that's a lovely thing to say, you know. So you see a whole lot of misleading statement, or you see, you know, occasionally you see falsehood, which is like, that's really a lie, just call it a lie. But this is a way that we get around, well, we don't know what the intention of the speaker was. And one thing I've seen, just as I'm tracking these sorts of shifts in language, particularly over the last 6-7 years, is that sometimes people are just like, look, call it a lie. It's clearly meant to deceive. Why are you not calling it a lie? And some news outlets have kind of done it. I've found a couple of headlines in the Washington Post or the New York Times where lie is used, where previously falsehood, misleading statement, that sort of thing would have been used. So you know, language is discourse, which means it's exchange of ideas and communication. So even these standards that journalistic outlets set for themselves regarding the uses of certain words, those should be affected and part of a conversation with the broader public's perception of what's happening
right.
in general.
I mean, Trump was the big problem because he was so reckless and so rhetorically untethered that it wasn't always possible to know whether he was intentionally lying or whether he just didn't know that what he was saying was not true.
Right.
And so assigning motive was a problem there. You sometimes notice that the media, the journalistic profession will make an almost collective decision, not like they had a meeting or anything. For example, for a long time, during the, to put it charitably, confusion over the results of the 2020 election, the word baseless became incredibly baseless, rather than say big lie, which is now kind of taken, or baseless was a big thing. But Peter Sokolowski, let's sort of walk him through something that's, you know, that's fairly recent, and that is the word grooming. So I'm going to, first of all, play a little clip by Fox News host and soul-eating Dementor, Laura Ingraham. And she is talking about this either in connection with Disney or the public school system or something else. She sees grooming everywhere she looks. Here we go. This is A2, Kat, A2.
Oh, my God. When did our public schools, any schools, become what are essentially grooming centers for gender identity radicals? As a mom, I think it's appalling. It's frightening. It's disgusting. It's despicable.
It's delightful. So, Peter, this term grooming, I mean, it's sort of an interesting word, too. Obviously, it's something that my dog experiences every 3 or 4 months. But I think this idea of grooming may have started in the same area of, there's an idiom, for example, to groom one's successor, which means, you know, you have somebody else who's working with you. You start preparing that person for a transition. And so it does have that history. And maybe you can pick up the story from there.
Yeah, I mean, to prepare is kind of a synonym, right? We say to get into readiness for a specific objective in Merriam-Webster's dictionary. But the big Oxford English Dictionary does have this precise meaning. They say of a pedophile to befriend or influence a child, now especially via the internet, in preparation for future sexual abuse. So crystal clear and a very peculiar usage, and one that is to be kind of honestly, it's new to me. It's only because of these recent news stories that I've heard about it. We trace it back to the mid 1980s. So it's been around, it's been out there. And what we find is that the language of politics is going in the same direction as so many of the other sort of concerns of the culture, which is identity. You know, terms of identity. And it's clear that that's what this is about. It's attacking, you know, one category of person or accusing them of one type of behavior. You know, they're certainly not talking about policy here. They're not talking about positions or campaign finance. They're going after individuals, and it's about identity. So it's kind of like calling people names. And it turns out that, you know, maybe the age of social media has been a regression for all of us, and it's sticks and stones all over again.
Although, okay, I'm going to push back against that a little tiny bit. And Peter and I have been having conversations like this, I think, for decades at this point. He is really, I think it's fair to say, partly because of his profession, what might be called a descriptivist. I mean, people who work in dictionaries, they're trying to figure out how the language is really getting used as opposed to how they think it should get used. I'm a little bit more of a prescriptivist. I think people should talk the way I want them to talk. And I don't know that that's exactly the knife's edge that I'm about to run my thumb down. But I do think, Peter, that, you know, here we have a situation where, yes, so grooming has a meaning that it acquired, let's say, to your point, in the 1980s of a pedophile preparing a child for subsequent sexual activity. The thing is that Ingraham and some of the other people who are slinging this word around, it's not clear that they mean that anymore. It's almost as though they're saying, if you introduce into the schools issues of gender fluidity, issues of just LGBTQ identity, you're maybe preparing children for a different kind of life that they would necessarily. It's not clear to me what they're saying, that Mickey Mouse wants to molest children or that third grade teachers are preparing their students in order to have sex with them. It's more like grooming in a much vaguer sense, like you're going to be kind of different. You're going to be a little bit more open to things that maybe some of us think you shouldn't be open to.
Yeah, whatever it is, it's bad. And yeah, so and they're using it as a paintbrush to paint others with. And of course, you're right.
Yeah. So, well, I'm just going to record that and play it back all the time. But but you know, that raises the question, Peter. Just stay with this for a second, of the role of the dictionary, particularly because you guys are doing so much work in real time these days, so much work online. So, I think you would still say that it's not that job of the dictionary to put up some guardrails around that word and say, well, that's not grooming. Just telling kids about certain things isn't grooming them. Grooming would be specifically, you know, what it meant in the 1980s. But if you're a descriptivist, well, maybe that is what grooming means now, because Laura Ingraham and Ted Cruz say it all the time.
Right. And so, you know, normally we're working on this entry and others. This has just sort of exploded into the public discourse. Again, a lot of people probably didn't know the term until recently. And just given the breakdown you just made, I would see two senses there. You know, mm-hmm. So a dictionary definition can, you know, split senses into two or more. And one might be that sort of older one that I read from the Oxford English Dictionary, and one might be this broader one, which is this sort of epithet use, this sort of more an insult than a precise, narrow accusation.
All right, so let's try another one of these G words, and this word will be gaslighting. So gaslighting, of course, comes from an old Charles Boyer picture. But I'm going to have both of you talk about it a little bit. Maybe, Peter, you can set the stage here. This wasn't a term that really moved out of the movie Gaslight and into the common parlance in a very smooth way, right? It just sat there incubating in its nest for decades.
Well, the linguist Ben Zimmer, our good friend, I mean, he does trace back the use in the sort of general sense of to deceive another person going back to the 50s, so shortly after that film and the play. And so, but it's come into kind of much wider use in much more recent times. And it's an extraordinary journey, but it's a word that's kind of gone through, you might say, what we sometimes call kind of semantic bleaching. In other words, it originally meant this very specific psychological manipulation over an extended period of time. You're driving somebody crazy, right? Whereas now it just kind of means, you know, liar, liar, pants on fire. You know, it's a little bit of a broader meaning in the way we see it on social media all the time.
We're going to circle back to semantic bleaching in just a second. This sounds like something out of our John Waters interview, but it's not. I interviewed him like 2 weeks ago, so it's still fresh in my mind. Corey, to that point, though, let me just sort of make my own stupid observation, and you can either exalt it or knock it down, and I'm not particularly invested either way. But it seems to me one thing that happens is sometimes people search for a word to describe a pervasive feeling, something that they are feeling and other people are feeling. And I saw, once again, sometimes driven by journalists, I'm thinking of Sarah Kendzior in particular, but we did a whole segment about gaslighting sometime during the Trump presidency, because when you have, I mean, the notion from the movie is that the husband is trying to convince the wife that she's crazy by just constantly messing with her apprehension of reality and by feeding her, you know, things that aren't true and causing her to doubt her own perceptions. And I do feel as though maybe there were a lot of people between 2017 and the end of 2020 who were looking for a word for just a lot of stuff that was coming at them that seemed to be almost intentionally messing with their own understanding of the world.
Yeah, I would agree. I also think that there's I don't know that I would say what's happening with gaslighting is semantic bleaching so much as it is a word that had a specific sort of psychological meaning. And then I do think you're right. People are looking for a thing to describe something that they are experiencing, and gaslighting seems to fit it. So there's this subtle shift in that gaslighting, you know, as taken from the movie, really is about trying to convince someone that their perception is incorrect. Whereas now it seems to be a word that gets used when someone is calling out someone's attempt to do that, right? So if I'm saying, you know, it's raining outside today, and you were to say, you know, that's just fog, I could say, quit gaslighting me. I don't think you're trying to make me insane or make me think I'm insane. But it focuses less on the impact that it has on the person being gaslit and more about the thing that is being debated now. So it's kind of a way of calling out straight up lies. But you're right. This is how words move and how they change meanings and how they change connotations is people look for something that kind of feels right and they take it on. You know, gaslighting also is a weird term because it, as soon as it sort of came to prominence, it also ended up being used a lot in discourse around Me Too, discourse around domestic violence, around feminism. And I honestly think that anytime you take a word that's sort of more broadly applied and women start to use it to say, this is my experience, you have an automatic knee-jerk response against it. So, you know, I'm thinking of, this was a while ago, but there was a New York Times writer who had said, you know, stop using gaslighting, gaslighting doesn't exist. And it's kind of like, well, if you have a bunch of people saying it exists and they are being gaslit, then does it not by definition exist? You maybe don't like how they're using it, but that's a different thing.
Well, there is, as you, I think, are implying at times, a way in which gender can condition perception, a way in which sometimes this is sort of fought out a little bit between men and women. This is not a perfect parallel, but not too long ago. But by the way, trying to enforce any kind of lexicographic integrity on Twitter is the stupidest thing in the world you could do. But I occasionally do it anyway, and I just was noticing somebody had, it was a woman, I hadn't even really picked that up, but had was asking people if there were TV shows that people didn't know too well, but that you, a specific person, were evangelistic, were evangelical about. And so I just sort of type back, this is a small thing, but evangelical and evangelistic don't exactly mean the same thing. At which point I was immediately accused of mansplaining. Which is another word that didn't exist too long ago. Yeah, Corey, what were you going to say?
I was going to say, I think that, you know, this gets into issues of how do we interact on social media? What does discourse look like now in the modern age? And I think that, you know, I know that we'll be joined later by another guest who has a lot to say about that. So I don't want to say too much, but I do think that, you know, one of the ways that as lexicographers, we track the evolution of language. And one of the ways that actually the internet makes it both great and really difficult is you can watch these things happening again in real time, which we never had the opportunity to do beforehand. But that means that you can't just say, oh, person X said this and person Y said this, so we're at person Y's idea. It is a constant back and forth. You know, language is like clay. You can't just throw it on the wheel and stick your hands in once and say, there's a bowl. You really have to work it over and over and over again. And as lexicographers, that means we watch a lot of this, and we just have to sit back and wait until meanings settle out enough that we can sort of grasp them in our hands, take them off the wheel, put them in the kiln, you know. But until then, it's not as if that word doesn't have a meaning. It's just that we as a group are trying to figure out what the most common denominator meaning is. And that's always the worst part of language change.
Well, that was a lovely extended metaphor, which, by the way, is no longer one of the top 10 words being searched for right now, although metaphor was earlier on that list today. So just to go back to something you said earlier, Peter, well, one could say that it might have felt to some people like gaslighting when the president of the United States stood before the nation at a briefing and suggested that it might be a good idea during a pandemic to inject bleach into your veins. But that's not what semantic bleaching refers to at all. But since it came up, you should explain what it is.
Well, the question is, did he mean it literally?
There we go.
Semantic bleaching is basically, words carry meaning. They often carry meaning. They usually carry meaning. There are function words and prepositions and things that don't always carry meaning. They help the meaning of other words. But if I said, did he mean it literally? That means, did he mean literally putting liquid bleach into into a person? That's one thing. But we also use the word literally in a hyperbolic way. I could say, I literally died laughing, and you'd understand exactly that I meant something was making me laugh very hard, but that I was in no danger of expiring. And so that's hyperbole. And what happens is, in that case, the words that are carrying meaning, which is to say died laughing, are understood to be a kind of a joke or a hyperbole, and literally is just, in this case, an intensifier. And once you make a word an intensifier, then it's no longer carrying the weight that it did in its normal initial use. And so if that happens frequently, then it actually takes on a new sense for the word. And this happens, like, literally is one that people notice. But it happens more frequently than you might think. I mean, think of the word incredible. If we use the same kind of etymological justice, then incredible means not believable, right? But you could say he's an incredible basketball player, and you could really mean it quite that way. But you could also say this ice cream is incredible. And well, it's perfectly believable that it's very good ice cream. And that's the way that language works. It slowly slowly changes meaning and becomes, in this case, an intensifier rather than carrying the original or etymological meaning of the word.
Right. I mean, the weird thing about literally is it almost gets inverted. It winds up meaning figuratively, which is, you know, its antithesis ordinarily. All right. We have to take a quick break here. As you can tell, all three of us could talk about all this stuff at great length, and we will continue to do that when we come back.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. The FDA has recently approved Zepbound, a new medication for chronic weight management. Dr. Davida Umashankar, Hartford HealthCare's System Medical Director of Medical Weight Loss, tells us more.
Zepbound helps decrease hunger and increase satiety levels. Taking this medication for 72 weeks, people can see at the highest dosage approximately 48 pounds of weight loss. So definitely a powerful drug and another powerful tool that we have to utilize to help individuals who struggle with obesity.
For those ready to explore their medical weight loss options, Dr. Umashankar has advice on the first most important step.
I don't think anyone knows you better than your own primary care physician. So having that conversation whenever you feel ready is so important because these medications are quite powerful and do need to be monitored on a regular basis.
To learn more, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
Hi, this is Colin McEnroe. You're listening to a podcast right now. You probably know that. But if you were listening on the air, you'd also know we're in the middle of a fun drive. And even though you're not listening on the air, you're listening to a podcast. That doesn't change the fact that we need your support. And one way that you can support this show that you maybe even love or at least like is to visit ctpublic.org/donate and make a donation today. Thanks for everything that you do already. We are very grateful.
Miss Ostrovsky, your word is boanthropy.
Oh, wait, one second, please. Ma'am, could you not sit in that seat? I saved a chair for my dad in the fourth row on the aisle. And it may take him a while, but when he gets here, that's his chair. 'Cause my mother's in an ashram in India. I saved a chair for her. She washes herself in the Ganges. And I live in a house where there's an oversized dictionary that I read as a girl on the toilet. I love my dictionary and I love the indented border. Every word's in alphabetical.
So we have two people with us today who are very familiar with dictionaries and love their dictionaries. Peter Sokolowski, editor-at-large, Merriam-Webster, Corey Stamper, lexicographer and author of Word by Word, The Secret Life of Dictionaries. So much to talk about here. You know, one thing I think that's kind of interesting to talk about is where words come from if they bleed into public discourse. And Peter, one place that they come from sometimes is academia, right? There's a way in which, well, James Carville says that this is faculty lounge talk that he doesn't think is particularly helpful. He says terms like Latinx and communities of color come up in academic speech and nobody actually says them in real life. He's constantly exhorting politicians to stop speaking Hebrew and start speaking Yiddish, which is to say, talk the way people really talk. But like one word for that, one word that's like that, Peter, is intersectionality, which I think arose or came into play anyway during the Black Lives Matter protests. Once again, it had been around for a while, but just in the faculty lounges, as Carville would say.
Well, yes, and it shows, I mean, even a word like deconstruction is a word that is much more broadly used today than it was, you know, in the 1970s, say, when, you know, Jacques Derrida and Paul Deman were at Yale. of course, its use in the public discourse is not always as sort of narrow or precise. And some words It's funny that he said Hebrew and Yiddish. That's really interesting, because I think in English we often say, if someone's using big words, we'll say speak English, you know. And there's a sense in which I think politicians have always known that. In other words, English has the kind of caste system. A lot of words are, like intersectionality, are derived from Latin if they come from a bureaucratic or an institutional or a religious or an academic or legal or medical setting. And yet, think of some of the great speeches. We will fight them on the beaches. We will fight them on the landing grounds. Every single word is from Old English. Ask not what you can do for your country. We have nothing to fear but fear itself. Every single one of those words, except for country, which is kind of an asterisk. It's from French, but it sounds English. And it's interesting that somehow a great rhetoricians seem to know this intuitively, which is to communicate with emotion and connect, which includes yes, we can, and it also includes make America great again. I mean, they're all the old English words. They're not the abstract or emotionally distant Latin words. And so what Carville was saying was the same kind of recommendation that George Orwell makes, and that Winston Churchill and FDR and JFK all apply in their own speeches.
Yeah, Orwell in Politics and the English Language talks about that and says that when you start to hear different kinds of words, you know that there's a very good chance that some abomination is being concealed. He says defenseless villages are bombarded from the air. This is called pacification, transfer of population or rectification of frontiers. It always means like something really horrible is happening that they don't want to talk about it. We've done it more contemporarily with collateral damage, things like that. And Corey, this raises a real question too for the lexicographer, because in theory, just to go back to what we said at the beginning, the lexicographer, the person who works on dictionaries, is, to use a John Robertsism, somebody just calling balls and strikes, right? You're not supposed to really necessarily have an agenda, and if you do, you should get rid of it. But how possible is that?
You know, I was raised in the lexicographical tradition that dictionaries are wholly subjective records of the English language, and over the course of 25 years of doing this, I actually think it's kind of impossible to have an objective record of the English language, period. You know, we all come to whatever work we do, whether it's writing dictionaries or making pizzas, with our own set of biases, our own opinions. And while good lexicographical training helps you see that, it is the water you swim in. It is just a thing that you have to contend with, that even what you have in front of you, you know, when we talk about writing definitions, people have this vision in their head that, like, we go into a smoky boardroom and bat around definitions for meanings. That's just not what happens. You basically sort of troll the written record for as much information, as many uses of a word as possible, and then you analyze those. But even in the process of doing that, you can't get all of English. You're going to privilege written communications over spoken communications, which is actually kind of where language grows and blooms and flourishes. And you're also deciding which things to include in a definition and which things not to include. So what gets really tricky, right, with some of these sort of politically fraught things is how much of your role as a descriptivist has to include a little bit of guidance. So for instance, we were talking earlier about the word grooming and how, you know, it started with a very, very specific sort of sociological, psychological meaning regarding how predators find and sort of gain the trust of victims. And, you know, it now is used in a very broad derogatory sense. Well, I, as a lexicographer, right now, for instance, I'm working on a dictionary for adults who are learning English as a foreign language, which means that they're not going to have the same cultural background that lots of us do when we hear someone like Laura, you know, Ingraham or Ted Cruz or whoever call someone a groomer. They don't quite understand what that means. Do I then want them to go to the dictionary and get this very clinical and incredibly sort of dense and fraught definition and think, oh, that's what that word means? So this gets really tense, because I don't think you can ever be fully subjective. I don't think you can ever be fully comprehensive in how you define a word. But I do think, particularly as dictionaries move online, and as people interact with them more, and as lexicographers move online and interact more, I do think that we need to rethink how we style dictionary definitions, what kind of information we include, and maybe we include usage notes or things that say this is used in a derogatory manner, or this is used as a generalized denigrating term, something like that. So, you know, just as online discourse is changing, so is lexicography.
Peter, could you just go ahead and respond to that?
Oh, I agree 1,000%. I mean, of course, I think to some extent, this prescriptive versus descriptive argument is a straw man argument, because the function of the dictionary is clearly prescriptive. It's obviously there to call balls and strikes for spelling. I love that song about the spelling bee. And by the way, you know, it hits me close to home. I'm this year a judge for the National Spelling Bee that starts in 2 weeks from today. So obviously that's the role, but the research is descriptive. So do you see what I'm saying? The two sides of a coin. A word like irregardless, which everybody loves to hate, but there's evidence of it in print. So there's reason by a strict descriptivist definition to put it into the dictionary. And we have to put it there. There's the spelling, there's the meaning. However, there's another kind of information, which is cultural, that the dictionary can give, which we call usage notes, just like Corey said. And so those are there to, first of all, keep you from offending others. And second of all, to keep you from embarrassing yourself. And I think that's a really important role for the dictionary too. But it's clear that the dictionary's role is, it's a paradoxical one. We want it to be sort of timeless, and permanent, and yet it's got to be up to date or it's invalid.
Right. I'm charmed by the fact that you think people are capable of embarrassment anymore. I think it's a fairly quaint notion at this point. But we have to take a little break here. As Corey was mentioning, we do have somebody who's going to join us. We're going to talk very specifically about the language of the internet, or what language is, what happens to language on the internet.
Cannot get on a bus because one hippopotami is two hippopotamus. And if you have two goose, that makes one geese. A pair of mouse is mice, a pair of moose is me.
We are back, and time to see some thank yous, especially to Kat Pastor, our technical producer, and most especially to our senior producer, Lily Tyson, who, it's always a mistake to try to produce a show that I have a lot of passion about, because then you have to deal with me for days on end. And so I've been driving Lily, I think, slightly crazy for the last 48 hours. So we're talking about words today with Peter Sokolowski, editor-at-large at Merriam-Webster, public radio jazz host at New England Public Media, co-host of the Word Matters podcast, Corey Stamper, lexicographer, author of Word by Word, The Secret Life of Dictionaries, and now joining us, Sylvia Sierra, linguist and assistant professor of communication and rhetorical studies at Syracuse University. Also the author of the book, Millennials Talking Media, Creating Intertextual Identities in Everyday Conversation. So first of all, welcome Sylvia Sierra. And if you were listening earlier, I'm keeping an eye for the entire show on Peter's site, the Merriam-Webster site, where they have this constantly refreshing list of words that are being looked up. And so gaff is still number one, but neurasthenia is number four with a bullet. Neurasthenia is having just a great day. But a few minutes ago, LOL was on the list, which will get maybe right into some of the stuff that we're going to talk about. But Sylvia Sierra, I thought maybe we could begin with the word meme, because it's actually something that I'm also somewhat passionate about. And I spent the entire spring using the word meme and saying to my students, no, not that kind of meme, the other kind of meme. So, but explain why there's other kinds of memes.
Yeah, so meme used to mean something much broader than what I think is what people usually mean by it now. So Richard Dawkins, you know, coined the term meme in his 1976 book, The Selfish Gene. And it was very broad, as I said. It could be any kind of like replicating cultural unit. So this could be like a fashion trend or maybe an architectural style. But he also did mention things like catchphrases being memes. And that kind of translates, I think, into the internet usage of memes. So more recently, when people talk about memes, they're typically thinking about internet memes. and sort of classically this might have been like an image with some text on it. And then maybe that would go through different permutations or it would just be shared that way. But it can be a lot of different things, like even, you know, like GIFs or GIFs, however you might pronounce that, that could also be seen as a kind of meme, you know, even just certain words or phrases. So it's a very, I guess, flexible concept. But yeah, that's kind of generally how it's changed. I mean, something a little more specific in the internet age.
Yeah, I feel bad about that, too. Yeah, so just if people are having trouble picturing this, just for example, there's a meme or sort of a starter meme that's, I think, a guy walking with who is somebody who's apparently his girlfriend, but he's looking back at a different young woman. And then all kinds of words get overlaid onto that to make some kind of point or to compare it to some other situation. But I thought Dawkins's coinage was so useful. I mean, it was sort of, he was basically making the argument that a unit of information that we could call a meme had a quote unquote interest in being passed along, being an interest in surviving, and that things would become successful in that way if in fact they had some very specific utility. And it was just a great way to look at little hunks of information and to talk about them. And then it got turned into something completely different. I think that old meaning is being lost. But we should also talk a little bit about, and this is one I'm sure that Peter and Corey would want to wave in on too, the way in which a term like fake news, first of all, isn't as new a term as you might think and has been stood on its head in the matter of 4 or 5 years. But Sylvia, get us started on this.
Sure. Well, so the people that work on dictionaries and lexicographers might know a little bit more about, you know, whether it was used prior to, let's say, 2016 and the U.S. election. I think that's sort of when it grabbed everyone's attention. And initially, it was actually used to describe misinformation about the election coming from like Russia or maybe some former Soviet satellite states. And it was, you know, mostly used by maybe like the mainstream media to talk about disinformation online around the election. And then what happened is the former president co-opted that term once he was elected, and he started just using that term fake news to refer to any media that he perceived as unfavorable to him. And it really took off then and became almost like his catchphrase and something that he really used to kind of connect with his voters and to just dismiss any media that he didn't think was favorable to him. And it kind of got reappropriated and used in a totally different way.
Yeah, and this is an idea that you gave us, although I'm going to take a step further, and Kat, we're going to get ready to play C1. I think we could call this the Inigo Montoya effect. Please.
Got very good arms.
He didn't fall? Inconceivable.
You keep using the word. I don't think it means what you think it means.
So there's a lot of that that goes on in life. I just would point out that, and I had to do some research on this a while back for some lectures I was giving. Fake news started to be slung around as a term in the late 19th century. In particular, it seemed to involve William Jennings Bryan, who oddly enough had lost an election and was continuing to cause trouble for McKinley, the person who'd won the election. And you come up with things like, there seems to be an epidemic of fake news from the city of Lincoln, Nebraska, and it all comes from Mr. Bryan's friends, names not given, Bryan's newspaper, The Commoner, wrote in 1907. But that term fake news is being slung around even back then. So our time is somewhat limited, but I think it is sort of interesting to talk about how our interactions with machines change the way that we think and talk and write. So, Peter, I mentioned that LOL had popped up on your Billboard Hot 100 a little while ago and then fallen off. You'd think that LOL would be a pretty well-resolved and understood term, but we don't know why people are looking it up. But it's an example of terms that have come into use because people are communicating on a completely different set of devices.
Well, absolutely. I mean, and especially with informal language, it used to be that that was the kind of language that was spoken and not written, not published, and therefore took a long time to get into the dictionary for the simple reason that gold standard that Corey mentioned before, this privileging of the written word in the documents that are used for research for a dictionary, we simply wouldn't have the jargon or the slang of any group of people. But now we have this paradox where the informal language is often written before it's ever spoken. So that's why we have problems like whether it's GIF or GIF, or you say LOL or LOL, for example. And that does mean, again, that we have lots of evidence of this use and therefore goes into the dictionary. This is the kind of thing that I think some people look up in the dictionary just to see if it's in the dictionary.
Right. And I think there are also ways in which words kind of, I don't know whether they cause social bonding or reinforce social bonding or reflect social bonding. But for example, Sylvia, you know, I mean, I don't know, all of my students know exactly what is meant when someone whose name is not actually Karen is referred to as a Karen. But that strikes me as one of those words that's sort of a way of sort of saying, I belong to a certain group and we call certain kinds of people Karen.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it also makes me think of the term boomer and how now that's used, you know, in a derogatory way a lot of the time by a younger generation. So, I mean, what you said is exactly right. These words are often used to bond people together as a social group, whether that's like creating a new bond or reinforcing an old one. That's definitely how a lot of these newer online terms or terms that maybe get popularized through online usage function. You know, you have to be part of an in-group to really get the subtle meaning of these words and who is included and excluded by it. And that's actually really clear with the case of like a Karen, because, you know, you're excluding people who you might identify as Karens. So it's definitely like an in-group bonding mechanism.
Although you wonder, like Corey, you wonder how stable any of that is, because as we've already talked about a couple of times, these things can be turned on their heads. And so a Karen, I think, initially might have come up in application to, for example, the woman who called the cops about the black guy who was bird watching in Central Park. That would be sort of a classic Karen activity. But I think increasingly, particularly because sort of the information engines of conservative and right-wing political discourse are very good at latching on to terms like fake news or Karen and turning them around and calling AOC a Karen, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Again, this gets into the war of words. And now we, you know, you have to also factor in the all-seeing algorithm and how the all-seeing algorithm is going to handle your words. You know, I'm thinking specifically of most of the younger people I know don't call COVID the pandemic. They call it the panini or the pando or the, you know, the Panera or whatever. And that's in part because they're all on TikTok. And for a while, TikTok would get everybody who mentioned COVID-19, they downrate it because they're trying to limit misinformation. So, yeah, I mean, these things come and go. Language is, by its nature, really fluid, and it is really changeable. If language isn't changing, it's dead. So it does get tricky then for lexicographers, people like me who have to say, what does this word mean right now, and put it in print. That's really difficult to do. But I also think this is how language has always been. And we're just confronted with a brand new way of absorbing and watching that language change happen.
Right. I mean, in a wonderful way, the kind of thing that you're talking about, immediately there's a need for a word to describe it. So the new word, the new coinage is algospeak. Algospeak is that exact thing of choosing a slightly different word and substituting it for something that could cause your post to be downranked. So if they're downranking everything that has to do with sex, you write S-E-G-G-S instead of sex.
Right.
That's algospeak, which is also part of what's called, I think, Aesopian languages that have their own kind of hidden codes so that people who are, to Sylvia's point, part of the in-group will know what they mean, and maybe the bot won't. Although the bots are getting, or the algorithms are getting really good and saying, we know what that word is. That's when you're trying not to get downranked. So, you know, Sylvia, to the point that we're talking about, too, there's a way in which and we only have about a minute left, unfortunately. There's a way in which this is supposed to work. Well, I'll give you an example. Okay, so millennials and Gen Zers, you know, they might use a term like girl boss. And that is something that they want to use among themselves. They're not really particularly interested in some creepy old guy who teaches a political science course using girl boss. The whole point is to have your own language.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that's always been the case for, well, especially groups that, you know, are minoritized in some sense, that they want to use sort of a language that is almost a code from people that have more power and that could maybe use that against them. But, you know, to your point about girl boss, I would say that one has also changed meaning. And now, like, me and other people I know would only use that ironically. We would never use that word seriously.
Well, we literally have to go. So thanks very much to all three of you. Wonderful, wonderful conversation. Thanks again to Lily and Kat, too. Never mind, I give up.